This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association. A half-hour program featuring interviews and commentaries relating to the unique natural environment and that we enjoy in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. I'm your host, Jay Schell. We are talking today with Sean Garrity, founder and managing director of the American Prairie Reserve, headquartered here in Bozeman and located north of Lewistown along U.S. 191. In his commitment to wildlife conservation, Sean set out to create the largest wildlife complex ever assembled in the continental United States. Mr. Garrity and his team are dedicated to building the reserve with the participation of Native American and other local communities neighboring the reserve, providing global visitors with educational and recreational opportunities. Leading the American Prairie Reserve project has enabled him to combine his business skills with his passion for wildlife to leave an extraordinary nature-based legacy for future generations. So, Sean, welcome. Let's start by just telling us how the idea of the American Prairie Reserve actually originated.
Well, thanks very much for having me, John. I appreciate it. Well, one of the more interesting things about this particular endeavor is that it's been around for so long. I mean, a lot of ideas endure, but this one is quite surprising. I would say the early 1800s, people started seeing this concept as a possibility. Uh-huh. What I mean by that is, you know, people started coming out, and of course, people have been here for many, many thousands of years, since going back to the Wisconsin Glacier, really. Thousands of years, but people started writing about it maybe late 1700s with the fur trappers from the Hudson Bay Company, then explorers that we know of like Lewis and Clark in the early 1800s, but folks like George Catlin, who was out more than 20 times in the 1930s and 1940s, Carl Bodmer, and many other explorers came, and they all saw, they didn't meet each other because they came at different times, but they all saw the same thing. That was a spectacular wildlife phenomenon in and around what we now call the Missouri Breaks. One of those people, George Catlin, as far as I know, one of your listeners may know somebody even earlier, was the first to call for the creation of a nation's park in this area, 1836. Oh, wow. On one of his trips out here, and said, you know, every time I come out, the wildlife here is like nowhere else anywhere I've been on the continent. We weren't a state at the time, of course, didn't say the words Montana. But in this area, the full ecology, both the breadth and the variety and also the population numbers, was a phenomenon that just didn't exist anywhere else on the Great Plains at that time. So he was the first person, actually sent a note to Congress with his paintings about that, did not lobby, he was an artist, not a lobbyist, but no traction then. But that's a long time ago. People throughout the ages also said the same thing. During our golden era of making national parks between the 1870s, started with Yellowstone up until the time we did most of our last ones, about the 1950s with Grand Teton, and that's when we tapered off and kind of stopped because it got very difficult to make anymore. We passed the grasslands up during that time. We were mostly making national parks, mostly for aesthetics, not so much for biodiversity and wildlife. But people said we should have done one on the grasslands at that time. We didn't get that done. We got Grand Canyon, the Everglades, and so many other beautiful, cherished places, but we called that era came to an end of making big protected areas, and we forgot the grasslands, or didn't forget. So now, many people through the 70s and 1980s came up with the idea. One I like to credit is a guy named Robert Scott, or known as Bob Scott, who came up with the idea of the Big Open. Really? And it was very similar to this area, and a little bigger, his ideas are bigger, about 5 million acres, and different in model in that it wasn't so much about public access, which we are, but it certainly was about growing wildlife populations again. And what is similar to us is what big wildlife populations being able to thrive in the midst of a robust agricultural economy. And he thought you could have both. He did a lot of traveling out there in the late 1980s and trying to sell the idea, perhaps a little too early. In the 1980s, things were not quite so receptive. Timing is everything, as you know, and became very well known. Bob Scott and the Big Open. But by the time we came around in the late 1990s, Things have changed quite a bit. Two other organizations are really important to note. Nature Conservancy, as they took this idea and quantified it from or clarified it from a scientific standpoint, mm-hmm. said if you're going to do something like this, this is one of the best places in the Northern Great Plains, all five states and two provinces of Canada, one of the best places to do it if someone were to want to do it. Where Wildlife Fund deserves a huge amount of credit for crystallizing that idea, taking it a little bit further, in the late 1990s, actually putting a lot of people on it and say, let's figure it out.
So how did you latch on to the idea?
Well, the story is to say the idea was well-formed and beautiful and thoughtful and very interesting. The trick is it got to the point where, almost to a fever pitch, it's time to do it. So who's going to quit their day job and sign up for decades do it? Who's going to do this nonstop and build a freestanding organization that exists to do nothing but this and nothing else? That was the trick. And that's what WWF was looking for, is what kind of a model. To make the story short, eventually the idea of a freestanding organization that only existed, its mission is to build this reserve and to do it in such a way that people in the agricultural areas end up being winners. It's not a us or them kind of thing, but a holistic solution and a holistic outcome. With holistic benefits, I want to say. And they set the idea of how to do it. It required someone to give up what they were doing, and that ended up being me. So I did not come up with the idea. Sometimes people say, I think I like this idea, the difference between creativity and innovation. Creativity is coming up with a spectacularly cool idea. Innovation is figuring out how to make it work. Yeah. So APR... it's a little bit black and white way to look at it, but we are the innovators that have to do the day-to-day, the devil's in the details. How do you make this spectacular idea work, but it was not our idea? It's WWF, TNC, Bob Scott, George Catlin, lots of other really amazing thinkers that moved it along, which is a really important part of a creative process.
So how did you get it off the ground?
Well, I've done a lot of this kind of thing before. Uh-huh. I grew up in Montana, mostly in Great Falls, but after graduating from Montana State University here in Bozeman, my wife and I in the early 80s was a bit of an economic bust here. I don't know if you remember, but it was a struggle for us. Uh-huh. We tried a lot of things and eventually left, like a lot of people said, we'll be back eventually. And a lot of my friends at that time left Montana to go try to build skills elsewhere. As in the early 80s, we ended up, after tried to be a travel writer or tried all different kinds of things, ended up one thing after another, after a series of failures, ended up in Silicon Valley with a good idea at the right time, 1984, and then uh-huh. took off, and a consulting company started, it's still going 35 years later, so mm-hmm. in Santa Cruz. But we wanted to raise our kids who were born in Santa Cruz back in Montana, so we got here back in 96. And I totally by accident stumbled across it. Completely by accident. My life was going just fine. I wasn't really looking for anything. And I had a good business rolling. I had to travel out of here quite a bit, but ran into some very, very inspiring people from More Wildlife Fund, frankly. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of happened that we need someone to take this and to just build an organization and slowly build it, get the compass heading set, get a set of values and a culture in the organization of achievement and accomplishment and tenacity and execution, pull people in that, you know, they were wired for that. Because it's going to be hard. It's going to take a long time.
So it took a lot of money. Where did you get the money?
Didn't have any money. And unfortunately, the friends I thought had money, I went out to ask them for money. And it was 2002, and that was coincided with a technology crash, and the stock market fell apart. So those were some grim years. We kept at it, and we eventually started to get some money in 2004, just enough. There were some pretty bad bumps and bruises in there where we almost called it quits.
Uh-huh.
Got a couple of lucky breaks, kept at it, and then we began to build from there. Staff of two, and now we have a staff of 45 or so.
Wow. So what was your first acquisition?
That was a down one we now call Sun Prairie. We found a property, been on the market for 3 or 4 years. And it actually was in the range of market value out there at the time, sitting way down in southern Phillips County and close to what's called the UL Bend.
On the north side of the Missouri River.
Yeah, we call it Sun Prairie. If your listeners download our map, you'll see Sun Prairie. Sun Prairie now is actually aggregation of four different properties we bought. So Sun Prairie looks like one, it's actually four. Mm-hmm. Almost all those blotches of blue you see on our map are big aggregations of 28 different purchases.
Mm-hmm. So did you have any cooperation from local people up there?
Some. As I said, we've done 28 purchases, and every one of those sellers, they have a different dream. So they put their property on the market. They want to go do something else with the value of that.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them just want to move to town and lease places and just calm down the intensity of having to own their own. So they're in the cattle business, but they lease it from somebody else. Mm-hmm. They don't own the dirt anymore, live in town. Some people wanted to move downstream in the value chain of the cattle business to get out of producing cattle and get into stockyards, into feedlots, you know, which is downstream in the business. Some people just want to move to town and just be retired. And after calving for 55 years in the winter, you know, I'm in my late 70s, time to move to town and enjoy my grandkids. So we had cooperators or people who were into the project.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly some people with fish, wildlife, and parks. Definitely people, range conservationists on the ground, range conservationists from Bureau of Land Management. And various people. There was plenty of people who didn't like the vision, but there are plenty of people who thought this is pretty exciting.
So was your original objective to restore a prairie site or to have a preserve for bison or diverse wildlife? What were you after?
Always, and when I took a look at this, I looked at this opportunity for more than a year, thinking about taking this challenge on, is one thing that got me was it wasn't about a particular species. It wasn't to save mule deer or pheasants or bighorn sheep or bison or wolves or bears. No individual focus on a species. It was about the whole thing. And I think sometimes I use this analogy. I've had the good fortune to travel to a lot of countries around the world. I like being in water, like being on coral reefs, you know, snorkeling or diving. And being on a coral reef, you feel really small and really tiny, and you learn how a coral reef works, the ecology, mm-hmm. from the microbes to the little stuff you can actually see with the naked eye, to the bigger and bigger things, all the way up to the sharks, whatever it is, and all the plant life that supports that. That full, complex, fascinating ecology I think, it's a good metaphor for how we ought to think about nature and how much we don't understand. So I like this project because it's not about any one particular species. It's about everything and understanding how it all interacts together on a landscape. And so the prairie is exceedingly complex, starting with the soil, microbes in the soil, and then the plants and the plant story, the grasses and the forbs and how complex that is and why that supports so many critters that fly, crawl, slither, walk, whatever they do, above that plant situation. I think it's like thinking about a gorgeous, beautiful nature situation like a 200-mile-long coral reef. You know, it's really cool.
So I've noticed in the newspaper that there have been a couple letters of expressing opposition to APR. Why do you have that opposition, and what are you doing to assuage it?
Well, that could be a whole show in itself, so we could do part two sometime if you'd like. We think about this a lot. I think most important thing is I've been doing this almost about 18 years now, so mm-hmm. I've spent many, many hundreds of hours in conversation with people in the project area about this. Some not altogether friendly conversations sometimes, but it's about a lot of things that's important. That it's not, you can't boil it down to any one thing. And I think the tricky thing, although the temptation is to say I'm right and somebody else is wrong, is realize everybody in the situation they're good people. Just a different idea on the highest and best use for this land, or is there enough room for everybody, or is it an either there only ranching, or can there be this kind of thing too? And there's no bad people, there's no bad actors, there's no right or wrong, I don't think, is my takeaway, is that people carry different worldviews about how land ought to be used. And it's one of the highest clash conversations you can have is how use of land anywhere in the world. So a lot of it is that, how much of it should be 100% food production or 80% food production. and this much wildlife or what. So I think for some people they're that this land, some people might hold a view that we are in trouble in terms of being able to, our possibility of feeding the world over the next 20 or 30 years as population increases, so we don't really have time to be messing around with these wildlife things. These are nice to haves. We ought to have pretty much every bit of land possible that can produce food. We should have it in food production. And taking out of production is not a good thing. There's some people that believe that. Some folks feel that this is a disruption to a very cherished and time-honored culture of cattle ranching. And having someone like us come in, we dilute that culture. It's not a, people enjoy that almost everywhere you go, it's rodeo that celebrates horsemanship. It's the stock sales and you see your friends there. It's beef prices and it's weather and all that. And it feels good. It's an affinity group. It's a tribal thing. And us coming in with a new idea at a pretty big scale like this can disrupt that lifestyle that people enjoy. Completely understandable.
And what are you doing to try to switch that?
Well, one is to say the way we look at it is even just the 6-county area where we're working, there's 450,000 cows in that area. 450,000 cows. And we may want to bring in a lot more wild, like, say, bison. People hear 10,000 bison. Is there room for 10,000 bison? Well, we think there's room for 10,000 bison surrounded by, in a sea of 450,000 cows. Yeah, we think there is. There's carrying capacity for that for sure. And if you take a look at Montana, Montana is roughly 96 million acres. Of that, 59 million acres is in agriculture. 63% of Montana is in agriculture. So to have out of 96 million acres, to have 3 million devoted to this kind of ecology in the grasslands, we think it can fit.
Mm-hmm.
Not to the detriment of the cattle industry that has 59 million acres or in agriculture. We think it can fit. We can think there can be both and. If you think about it at a pure scale level. If you look at it at a big enough level about what can fit in Montana, what can fit in northeastern Montana. And I think some of the issues that are happening with some of the communities there were happening a long time, for like 90 years of population decline. I don't think APR can take all the fault of some towns getting smaller, school consolidation. That's been happening since around World War I, very slow. By the 1990s, it was in a situation where it was drastically different than what it was 80 years before. So I think another thing I try to say, doesn't always go over so well, is when you have an economy based on one industry, whether it's logging or coal mining or fishing or ranching, you're at risk because efficiencies in that industry are going to march forward. The more efficiencies you have in that industry, every decade you need less people to do that. You have more cows out there really than ever before, almost 500,000 cows in those mm-hmm. 6-county area, and today less people running those cows than ever, and that's going to continue. Less and less and less people in the industry are needed through efficiencies. And so adding some diversity, some economic diversity, not a replacement, but just a more diversified portfolio of industries, can be helpful.
And what's been the economic benefit to communities in the vicinity?
Well, I want to be careful about saying this is a silver bullet or a panacea to any kind of economic struggle someone mm-hmm. an area might be. But I don't think it'll make matters worse. I think it can be better than neutral over time. We're early days, by the way. This is a construction project. So we're probably about, you think about what we're trying to do to where you finally get the impact of it, or maybe a third of the way into it. But we can show in the rearview mirror that we've brought thousands of people from around the world that wouldn't have otherwise come. They do spend money. They are interested in building infrastructure. They're putting a different kind of a spotlight on this area of northeastern Montana, actually a subset. A small area around the breaks. And we're bringing in people that are following a trend. So I was just talking with a large group of hunters, and in Lewistown, there's a hunting store that closed, an outdoor store that closed recently, And the owner of the store had it for two generations and said an interesting trend over the 60s, 70s, and 80s until today is people coming in to hunt to get targets, bullets, guns, holsters, things like that, has slowly gone down, but their business has stayed largely the same, but it's replaced with a new group, wildlife watchers, binoculars, sandals, big floppy hats, I forgot my sunglasses, I need some polarized sunglasses, etc., bug spray. So the same number of people coming through the door, what they're looking for is the demographic has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Wildlife watchers, or people wanting to be in nature, is a steadily growing thing, and we're trying to take advantage of that. Our parks are overrun, that would suggest we don't have enough parks.
So you're inviting people out onto the reserve?
We're building infrastructure, one of the largest hut-to-hut systems in the United States, probably about 180 miles long when it's done, so people can come in at a reasonable price. Regular people, not wealthy people. We're just finishing our second campground on the highway on 191. We have another one that's quite popular. It's about 50 miles in and on gravel, so it takes a hardier person to go in there. It's full of elk hunters right now. For $15 a night, with power and water and all that. So we're trying to let people see this in a different way than it's been looked at for a long time. And trying to help to create some employment, too. It's a different kind of employment. But just last week, we finished a training program for being naturalist guides. And we had people from Fort Belknap, Native Americans, who wanted to be trained to be naturalist guides, come over. And it was a rigorous 10-hour-a-day first session that went from Sunday till Friday and just finished a couple of days ago. So if you go out there and you say, I want to camp on this campground. Can I hire a naturalist guide to take me and my parents and my grandkids around for a day? Can I pay $115 for a naturalist guide? Well, down the road, as we get this program moving along, you'll be able to get, you know, a 26-year-old woman, Assiniboine woman, to come and take you, or you and your family, and tell you about the glaciers and the ice age and the pollinators and rabbits and how all that works and weather and seasons and all those kinds of things, and you're listening to a Native American who lives there and has been there for hundreds of years being a naturalist guide. I think that's pretty exciting. So over time, it has the potential to create some new kinds of employment that some people wouldn't have thought of.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Sean, I think we're going to do this in two parts.
Okay.
So this is the end of part one. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by Gallatin Wildlife Association. We've been talking today with Sean Garrity, founder and managing director of the American Prairie Reserve, headquartered here in Bozeman. You can find out more about APR by going to www.americanprairie.org. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Thanks for listening.